Jesus said, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light."
Thanks, Graham. Okay, we're just going to pray. Dear Lord, in these strange times in which we are living, many people are feeling heavily burdened, fearful and unsure. Grant us peace to trust that you can help us to carry whatever burdens we are feeling and to know your presence with us this morning as we meet together. We pray for Sophia as she brings her message to us and ask that you will bless her and all her family as they deal with this different life. Help each of us to be open to your word and to listen for your voice in all we hear this morning. In Jesus' name.
Amen.
We're blessed this morning to have Claire's friend Sophia with us. This morning she will be talking to us about living with fear, something which is a big topic for her clients at all times, but in particular at this time of the COVID pandemic. It is also a topic which Sophia has had some personal experience with, as many of those among us have. I'm sure it has also been something that has touched each of us to some degree during this current crisis. There has been so much media coverage that it is constantly in front of us, even though we in Perth and in Australia generally have not had to deal with the devastating consequences we see on our screens and in the news that is happening in other countries. I'm sure for many of us there is a worry at the back of our minds that things could suddenly get worse here. But what is fear? Fear is a natural, powerful, and primitive human emotion. It involves the universal biochemical response as well as a high individual emotional response. In other words, it is a natural response to situations which could be stressful or dangerous, and we all experience it. It can also be a symptom of some mental health conditions, including panic disorder, social anxiety disorder, phobias, and post-traumatic stress disorder. So that's what it is. I'm sure we have all experienced it to some degree today. So I thought that it might be a good time to voice what sort of things we are fearful of, things that you find scary or you are anxious about, especially at this time with all this talk of the pandemic. I thought maybe if the kids are around too, they might like to give us some of their thoughts about things that they're scared of or they're fearful of. Okay, so any thoughts from anybody? Oh, no one's scared of anything?
I will. Being scared of taking that chance, an opportunity presents you and taking that leap of faith, I think, you know. I'm just looking in front of me, looking at two different paths, looking at where I wanna go and what I wanna do. I'm a caring person, I love helping people. So it's disability care. And I'm a musician. I absolutely love music. It makes me so happy. And I've met this person, local person online that has his own music school. And it's making me a little bit nervous. So, you know, being scared to take that leap of faith, I guess.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens.
Yep. That's great. Want to do that.
I don't have a picture up, so I can't wait. Marita, I was just going to offer that I think as a lot of us who've been raised to be good church-going, Christianity-abiding folk, one of the things that we fear is this very conversation, because we're not supposed to be people that get frightened. We're supposed to be people who are presenting a together, comfortable and composed front at all times. And I think so for many of us, people who've been raised this way, fear is the thing that lurks in the shadows that we often don't know how to acknowledge and don't know how to talk about because it frightens us.
Yep.
Marita, one of the things that springs instantly to mind is public speaking for me. Hate it. Can't.
I agree. I'd rather sing it.
I wouldn't do that either, but public speaking is like, yeah, if I could not do that, that would be good. And that engenders fear. Yeah.
Yep. Anyone else got things to say?
Fear is very important to us. It helps keep us alive, especially going back to, you know, several thousand years back when people were living, hand to mouth virtually on their own, looking out for threats, looking out for food, etc., being very alert and able to respond quickly to things that might happen. So that may be a positive side of fear. I don't know.
For me right now, I think for many, there's just an underlying disease or fear about the uncertainty of it all. So I think being fearful or anxious about unlimited or too much uncertainty is what can trigger it for me at different levels. And the other for me as a self-employed person, few weeks and months has been, again, ebbs and flows, is fear about financial income and financial security.
Mm-hmm. I remember the first thing that came to mind for me was when I was a little girl and there were storms and I was terrified and I would charge through the house and leap onto my parents' bed and refuse to go back to mine. I'd be glad to know that I didn't do that with the last thunderstorm. The other thing is, I guess for me, I am afraid of what, where I'm sort of heading with the Alzheimer's and how that will go. But I really don't think about it all that much. I don't lie awake thinking that yet. So, yeah, it's me.
Anyone else? Tyson?
When you asked the question, my immediate thought was I'm scared about losing my family or something bad happening to someone I love. And I think what sits underneath that, and as everyone else has been talking, what it seems to fit for me as well, I fear loss, I guess. I fear things changing and losing what I have, so that makes me scared about the future, about what's going to happen, and am I going to lose something? Is something going to happen so that what I hope the future looks like isn't going to happen? So there's something about being concerned about losing something.
Yep. Lee, were you waving before?
Yeah, I was. Do you want me to say something? Is there time?
Yeah, you've got all the time as well. Do not my service.
Okay. I was going to say, I'm a bit afraid of what other people think of me, in particular that they'll think I'm not cool or that I'm a bit stupid, or something I've said is really ridiculous. So I guess that's social anxiety.
You're not cool, Lee.
Thank you. I sort that out up front. It's good.
Yep. I share that fear, Lee. I often worry about people criticising me or disapproving of me or thinking I'm an oddball or a dork. But I also have a fear at the other end of the scale. I fear a conflict between America and China that could do terrible destruction to the whole world.
Can I just say on the matter of those sort of big fears, The other day I was out walking and there was a big flock of ibis up ahead, and I, knowing how skittish they are, I was approaching closely and they were gradually moving out of my way. But there was one of them that had his head down and didn't notice me coming until I was much closer, and of course got a fright and jumped a bit, and of course the entire flock took off. And I think that is a bit of a picture of what we can be like sometimes, where we can respond to other people's fears because, you know, somebody else has reacted to it. We also react before we've had time to think.
Sophia, you need to unmute you.
Just in response to Michael's comment, that's what happened with the toilet paper, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Fear of loss of toilet paper. Anyone else got anything?
I was just reflecting last night with Rosie, actually, that I notice the fearlessness that I have when I'm in nature.
Less fear in
nature. Yeah, on the opposite scale. I notice how fearless I am when I'm surrounded by the natural environment.
Catherine?
I'm agreeing very much with what everyone has been saying. I just wanted to add on a personal note. I was at my IGA yesterday doing groceries and I was told I could only buy one tin of tomatoes because there's a tomato shortage. Right. And that's, I was like, because I use tomatoes often with my cooking.
I have to use raw ones instead. There doesn't seem to be a problem with those. Anyone else?
I'm afraid of being alone more than anything else. Yeah. So I just try and reach out to people and try not to be as much of a dick. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, these are all very valid concerns, things to be worried about. God does not want us to be fearful. He wants us to trust in him. The phrase fear not or don't fear is found at least 80 times in the Bible. I have asked a few people to read some of these references.
This is from Isaiah 43. But now this is what the Lord says. He who created you, Jacob, he who formed you, Israel, do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have summoned you by name. You are mine.
This is from John 14:27. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give you. Do not give to you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled and do not be afraid.
From Joshua, have I not told you, be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go.
From Psalm 23, verse 4, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me.
And from Psalm 34, verse 4, I sought the Lord and he answered me. He delivered me from all my fears.
From Romans 8, for I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus, our Lord.
From Psalm 118, verse 6, the Lord is with me. I will not be afraid. What can mere mortals do to me?
Thanks to all those people who did their reading. That one from Romans is one of my favourites. We learnt that as a song when I was in youth group or something, and it's always stayed with me. It may seem simplistic, that you can just think, well, God will always be with you. And I know that when we're scared and overwhelmed or afraid, it's hard to remember and rely on God's promises. But if we believe in him, then he can help us overcome our fears. He may also send us the help of good friends, psychologists and counsellors to talk to. We may need some medication to assist with anxiety. All of these things may be God's way of sending us the help we need. But we can also hold on to God's promises that he will be there for us. Our own Paul Joyer reminded us of this in the song, Jesus and Me. When I'm feeling frightened and small, I don't have to worry at all, but he makes me feel strong and tall, Jesus and me. I think Paul demonstrated this understanding of God's care for him all the way through his life, and I thought we'd listen to his song to remind us to trust Jesus. Feel free to sing along at home, and don't forget to whistle nonchalantly at chorus.
A what? Two. A what?
Sophia, you've got stars on the screen because you're a star for talking to us this morning. We're really pleased that you could join us, and we're looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Lovely. Okay. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Marita, for that beautiful introduction. Thank you so much for having me. As someone who's not spoken in your church before, now this is a bit of a weird thing that I'm still trying to wrap my head around. How do you acknowledge country on a Zoom? Because usually if I'm speaking in a meeting, I would start by acknowledging country. So just to let you know, I'm on a Wobbegal country. So that's the country that I'm acknowledging this morning. Obviously that's not the country you're all on, but that's the country I'm on. So I would like to pay my respects to elders past and present of the Wobbegal Nation, and to honour leaders emerging as well. Okay, As Marita so beautifully introduced, I'll be speaking very, very broadly today about fear in the time of COVID-19. I got a really broad brief from Claire, and I ran with that very broad brief. So let's just see how we go, okay? As Marita mentioned, that's us. Some of you will remember crossing paths with us back when we were with you in 2018. I purposely picked a photo of us that was unflattering to me so that no one else in my family would bicker with me about whether it was a good photo of them. But that's us as we used to show up to your church back then. And now, and we live in Newcastle. Okay, so what I'm hoping to do today, just as a brief mud map. The first thing is I'm going to try to tell you about what I know about fear. And to tell you what I know about fear in the context of COVID-19, I'm going to talk to you about what I believe my faith tradition says about fear, and to offer you what I can about living with fear and how that can be done. And I'm also going to try to avoid being a B-grade Claire, because as you all know, I love Claire and I love her talks. I really love the information that she gives over in that, but I knew right from the get-out when I tried to start writing this that I can't attempt to do that. So that last point there is more of a reminder for me to not try to mimic that. I can only offer you what I can offer you, and you have Claire other times. Okay. Okay, so let's talk briefly about fear as I've encountered it. As Marita was saying, in the wide diaspora of counselling and therapy as it's offered in Australia, I work from the little corner that's called clinical psychology. I'm a clinical psychologist. So from my memory of your church community, you've got other people around you who are also therapists, counsellors or psychologists as well. So I know I'm not alone in that endeavour. And as I continue to speak, those of you who worked in other types of therapy would probably pick me pretty quickly as a clin psych in terms of the gaze that I bring to this. So I just want to own that, not to try to say that that's a better gaze to bring, but just try to acknowledge that that's the way I look at things. I do tend to look at things from a clinical psychology perspective. So from that perspective, what I can tell you is that, yes, there are lots of different definitions out there, the difference between fear and anxiety. But for much of the time, those definitions don't work as well, aren't as clear when people are in situations of prolonged and variable threat, such as living in a house where there's domestic violence occurring, or such as living in a refugee camp when you never know whether your food source is going to be guaranteed for the next few weeks, even though it's okay right now, or such as COVID-19, when the information keeps changing, we're still instructed to live differently to normal. The fear might not be the trigger of distress might not be right up in our face, but it's still real and it's prolonged and variable. So our definitions of the difference between fear and anxiety don't work quite as well in this sort of context. But generally speaking, fear is understood to be an emotive state, an emotion that's often, but not always, accompanied by a physiological response, a body response. So that's the stuff Marita was summarising so well when she introduced me. There is a set of body responses that go with emotions of fear, and sometimes that's referred to as the fight or flight response. Can everyone just nod if they've heard that term before? They're kind of familiar with it? Yeah, okay. Often but not always accompanied. The two things don't always go together. Sometimes it's possible for someone to be absolutely terrified but they've run out of adrenaline and they don't have a physiological response. Sometimes it's possible for someone to have a physiological response even though they don't have an emotion of fear, even though that sometimes follows hot on the heels. That's a common experience, particularly for people with panic disorder, that the physiological response comes first and then the thoughts come afterwards. The perspective I would also bring is that just as a general principle, I believe that emotions, they can very much be influenced, but they can't always be controlled, and that we're selling people short if we tell them that if you try these two or three cute little strategies, if you click your heels together three times and walk around the block twice a day, you will not feel fear or anxiety again. That's not actually the reality of the situation. There's a lot we can do to influence what emotions show up for us that are unpleasant. And a lot of that is, you know, the bread and butter of clinical psychology. But at the bottom of it is the acceptance that we can't always control emotions. I also strongly believe that there's no ethical dimensions to emotions. I believe that there's no right or wrong with emotions. As I was taught when I was in year seven at my Catholic high school, emotions aren't right or wrong. Emotions just are. Because there's no element of agency or choice in emotions, sometimes then it's not, there's no ethical dimension to it. We can't be judged to have done the wrong thing in having the emotion in the first place. The ethical aspect of the situation is about the choices that we make when that emotion shows up. I guess the other perspective that I would bring generally is that in my experience working with people is that, yes, fear can be a really unpleasant emotion. There's lots of unpleasant emotions. Some of us here in our group today, for some of us, fear will be the most unpleasant emotion we have. That's the one we hate the most. For other people, anger will be the emotion that we hate the most or just dislike the most. Generally speaking, the efforts that humans make to avoid experiencing their most unpleasant emotion do more damage to their quality of life than the actual emotion ever would. I guess that's also a foundational concept, working with people in psychology from that perspective. So just to give a bit of a background about the clinical encounters that I've had in my work with fear, you know, how I meet it in the clinic room when I'm sitting with clients. And I'm sorry to say I'm probably going to accidentally use the word patients when I talk about people I work with, but that's because I work in a hospital and everyone I meet is pretty much a cancer patient. So please excuse me if I use the word patient. It's just because I work in a hospital. So people I work with, and I'm sure other counsellors in the meeting today would agree with me, unfortunately the bread and butter work of working with fear as an Australian when you're offering counselling is with people who have survived domestic violence and childhood abuse. I'm sorry to say those experiences are far too common and make up the bulk of our clinical work often. So that's the majority of the experience I've had. I've also had the opportunity to occasionally work with combat veterans, people from refugee communities, and other groups that are experiencing something that fits into the description of post-traumatic stress disorder. And obviously fear is a part of that. I've also had the opportunity to work with people with anxiety disorders. The most common being, I guess, social anxiety and phobias and panic disorders. Panic disorders, as some of you know, they don't get much talked about in the community, but they're a really awful condition to be stuck with. There's nothing elegant about treating a panic disorder. It's just hard yakka. It can debilitate people quite quickly, and panic disorders left untreated are likely to become something like social anxiety or agoraphobia. So we've got to get in quick and help people when they have that presentation. I just wanted to make a special mention to another presentation that's not so common, but I think it's important for our discussion today. And that's people who have a particular subset of OCD that's sometimes referred to as scrupulosity or religious OCD. So that's people who have obsessive compulsive disorder and for whom their obsessions focus on their relationship with their spiritual community or with God. So it's people whose actual nature of their illness is the fear that they're not pleasing God, that they've had blasphemous thoughts, that they haven't been correct in their religious observance. And that can be crippling. And that's not a huge percentage of the population, but I just think that's a wonderful example to hold up to the aspects of Christian culture. Ken, I think, Ken, you were referring to it earlier, but the messages that we get in Christian culture about how fear is by itself a definition of lack of faith. So I think let's just keep people with that presentation in mind as we keep talking today. And more recently, since 2013, I've worked exclusively in the area of oncology. So I work in a public hospital talking to people who've got cancer or their loved ones. And the fear that I encounter in that work is pretty much exactly what you would expect I would encounter. I encounter we work with fear and shock about diagnosis or people's fear about the chronic illness and the pain they might experience as a consequence of their cancer, fear of the actual treatment itself, fear of all the things that they could lose, everything from body image to sexual functioning to income to relationships to a sense of self, to years of their life. So many losses go with a cancer diagnosis and treatment, and there can be fear attached to every single one of that cascade of losses. Then, of course, there's the fear of approaching death. And then this particular category called fear of cancer recurrence, which is so common, it's basically got its own literature about the nature of this situation and how to treat it as a psychologist. Fear of cancer recurrence, as you could imagine, is a really common experience after someone's had a cancer diagnosis and then had treatment. There's a particular kind of that which is called scansiety, if anyone's ever heard that term. Can anyone nod if they've heard that term, scansiety, in relation to cancer? Scansiety is the fear that people experience as they come up to the next set of scans. So they may have had a cancer diagnosis 2 years ago, been treated, regained reasonable physical health, but every year they've got to front up to that treatment centre and undergo a set of scans. And the week before those scans and the time between that scans and the appointment when they discuss it, for a lot of people, it's a time of high fear and high anxiety, and that experience is so common it's referred to as scansiety in the cancer context. And my own experiences of fear, and I talk about these today not, again, to try to outrank anything else I'm talking about today, but just to acknowledge that as a human, of course, I've had my own experiences with fear, and no doubt how I've got through those experiences informs how I conduct myself in my therapy practice and also informs my faith experience hugely. So as some of you might know, in 2010, Matt and I had a third daughter. Her name was Salome. She was born after a very standard healthy pregnancy and a pretty standard labour that went absolutely pear-shaped in the last 20 minutes. She was born in very poor health. She lived for 2.5 days in the NICU of the hospital where she was born, and then she died. So that was our third child. Salome died because she became infected while she was in my uterus with E. coli. That was the reason why she died. And 6 months later, I was pregnant again. There's this terrible medical term called colonized uterus. That was the medical term to refer to me. I had a uterus that was colonized with E. coli. So my consequent pregnancy was high risk. I went through that entire pregnancy at quite reasonable risk of the baby I was carrying also contracting E. coli and dying. And as is often the experience for people who've experienced baby loss, when you go through the subsequent pregnancy, the entire experience is jam-packed with triggers of your trauma. So for a lot of people after they've lost a baby, and I'm sure there's other people in the group who've lost a baby, that's, you know, I should acknowledge that too. That's actually, it's a bit of a myth to say it's a rare experience. It's not that rare, you know. I'm sure I'm not the only person in the group who's lost a child in this way. But when you go through the next pregnancy, every set of pregnancy scans, every visit to the obstetrician, every blood test is triggering again. And for me, part of that experience was constant nausea, which was, you know, triggering as well. So I had my fear to deal with throughout that entire pregnancy, every day trying to gauge, was there enough kicks, was there not, was there enough movement, and could we get that baby out alive and breathing? And obviously continuing to mourn the death of our third daughter, Salome. And just the tiny aspects along the way of that experience of, say, we had to delay putting a headstone on Salome's grave because we did not know how many babies we'd be putting into that grave. It was very difficult for me to form a relationship with the next baby as it grew in my uterus because I didn't know whether I'd be getting, or in what state I'd be when I met this baby. That baby's our Jonah, the big-headed, boofy boy who's now 9, who was popping in and out of the shot earlier today. That pregnancy went beautifully well. I was beautifully supported medically. I got lucky and I got a live, healthy child at the end of that one. And some of the fear that's continued through the rest of my parenting experiences has been just having to manage the day-to-day fear of I could lose another one at any point. You know, once you know that, once you know how fragile, how close we all are to losing someone, you can't put that information back in the box. And so I've taken years to sort of find my feet with that, not be crippled by that. Okay. All right. I'm going to talk briefly about that's kind of the background, right? And now I'm going to talk briefly about COVID-19 and what's changed in the fear that I see and what my own fear experience in COVID-19 context. Okay, so as you can imagine, for people with cancer, COVID's been particularly tricky. They've had all the other fears that they normally have and then new fears on top of that. They worry about their aged parents just like everybody else. For people who were meant to be starting chemo after COVID kicked off, that was a very difficult decision. Do you want to proceed with a treatment that dismantles your immune system in the context of a pandemic? For people who were scheduled to do treatments, unfortunately, hospitals needed to say to them, you can't bring a loved one for your first chemo round. You can't have a support person there when you go in for radiotherapy. That was really hard. Still is hard for people. People feared that the deaths that they thought they were going to have weren't going to be as they planned because there was restrictions on who could come to hospices and what palliative care services continue to be able to go to people's homes. So all those conversations were occurring. And then a theme I kept hearing from a lot of my clients, I continue to hear, is actually my cancer's given me a head start to adapt to COVID. I feel like my prior experiences of facing my mortality, suddenly going to a lower income, months I've already spent having to be isolated and very aware of my infection risk, I feel like I've really started this whole process with a massive head start on the rest of the community. So that's how it was going in early March. And then on March the 15th, and I'm not talking out of school here because this is all on the public record. On March the 15th, the second COVID-19 case in my health district occurred in a patient at our hospital. And everything changed overnight. Our patients' fears increased, so then my workload as a clin-psych increased because all my clients were distressed. As a clinician, I was trying to stay abreast of the new information and make big system changes quickly. And the work was really tiring, but felt purposeful. There was a constant stream of information about how big the numbers could get for COVID, like having those conversations in March 15th about, okay, so it's likely to peak in late April, and this is what our hospital, how our hospital will work when that occurs. And we're also having difficult conversations about our ethical guidelines, about how to work out who gets what ventilator and how that process would work out if the need arose. And then in my personal life, I needed to get COVID tested at that point. Our school stopped and suddenly our three kids were home together a lot, which is its own cause for fear, just their fear. And how hard that was for them. And I guess as someone working in an Australian hospital as this was all rolling out, this is another aspect of fear for health professionals in Australia. So this is just a screenshot of a memorial board online that's set up to honour some of the healthcare workers in the UK who've died from COVID-19. So I think the confirmed cases of healthcare workers in the UK who've died from COVID-19 is something like 147 at the moment, but the odds are it's probably almost twice that. And when you read through the obituaries of these people, it's really striking how many of them were aged under 50, had no comorbidities. So that's in the back of our mind as healthcare workers. Yes, of course, we want to do the right thing by our clients and the community, but the fear is real about what this could mean for us and for our families. And particularly for our doctors and nurses who are into research and publish. When people are into research and publish, they often have personal relationships with professionals who do similar work overseas. So for a lot of our doctors and nurses who are into research, this has been really heartbreaking times because they've known some of these people. They know intensivists working in Italy. They know other nurses who've been on the line, front of the line in the UK. It's been quite scary for them. Okay. So that's a bit of context from my perspective. So now I'm going to talk, just offer you what I can about how do we engage our faith with our fear. I'm so glad, I think it was Ken was making those points earlier. Thank you, Ken, for the fantastic segue. And I'm also really glad that we started with that really great set of biblical quotes about fear. So that's, I guess, the first thing our faith says to us about fear, about what God wants us to know about fear. And we read some of those beautiful quotes together just, 20 minutes ago. And there's other aspects of our Christian culture. And if you go looking on the internet, I'd invite you to do this, just Google faith and fear Christian. This is the sort of stuff that comes up over and over again, that faith is indicative of, that fear is indicative of a loss of faith, that faith should defeat fear, that if we're feeling fearful, we're not living as an Easter people, and we clearly need to pray harder, pray smarter, pray more in order to make our fear go away. And I find that stuff very problematic, to say the least. And I tell you who I reckon's strongest at it, it's actually the Mormons. I don't know about your views, but the Mormons are all over Pinterest. They're fantastic at it. They do great memes. They're on point. Their branding is very strong. And this is one of their elders. He didn't make this statement recently, but from what I can see, Mormons love this statement and whack it about quite a bit. But it's similar, I guess, to the other concepts from different parts of the Christian tradition, that to be fearful indicates poor faith or lack of faith, or a faith fail, I guess. So here's what I think, and unlike Claire, I'm not going to be able to give you any background about why I think this or kind of support my argument anyway. I'm just going to lob it in there. This is just what I think. I strongly believe that in the biblical quotes in the Bible, Jesus is not telling us to avoid or suppress an emotion. I don't think that's what Jesus or God is doing. I think to some degree Jesus is telling us to be careful about the choices we make regarding how we live when we feel fearful. I think there's instruction in the Bible to be aware that when we act from fear and we let fear guide us and direct our choices, then we're at risk of harming ourselves and others. I regard the biblical statements about do not to be afraid very similarly as I regard the biblical statements about the gospel statements about love one another. In the gospel directives to love one another, I do not believe that we are being directed to maintain an emotive state. I believe that those directions are about acts of will, taking action, choices we make. And similarly, I don't believe that we're being instructed to avoid one emotion or create another one. We're being directed to bring our attention to how we behave in the context of those emotions. I think that fear is an unavoidable aspect of human existence. And when you strip away those layers of meaning that is cluttered with these days about it being indicative of poor faith, when you take all that crap away, it's just another type of human suffering. No more meaningful or any less meaningful. Definitely difficult. And how are we responded to? How are we directed to respond to human suffering? First and foremost, with compassion. And that includes compassion extended to ourself if we feel fearful. So I believe that step number one is a compassionate response. And I guess just for those counsellors in the meeting, it would probably be pretty obvious to people that there's a particular type of therapeutic intervention called acceptance and commitment therapy that has a famous metaphor called the bus metaphor. And I guess that's the closest parallel I could draw between my clinical work and my position on that from a faith perspective is this idea of the bus metaphor means basically when you're going somewhere you want to go, when you're living a life of purpose and you're moving towards something that matters to you, sometimes doing that sets off your fears, your anxieties, your anger, your sadness, your shame, and yucky thoughts that bug you. And sometimes you can't kick those off the bus. You can't necessarily kick those thoughts or those emotive states out of the experience. But they're going to show up when you go in the direction that you want. The main thing is that they don't drive the bus. That's the point of the bus metaphor. You don't let your fear drive the bus. Sometimes it's going to show up, but you don't let it set your course. Someone I find particularly useful in this sort of discussion is Kate Bowler. Kate is an American woman. She spent 10 years immersing herself in American prosperity gospel communities and developing relationships with people in those communities to work out why they believe that the way they did. She wrote this lovely book as a consequence of that called Blessed, A History of American Prosperity Gospel. So a core belief of those churches is that illness, poverty, and feeling fearful are all signs of a lack of faith. She released that book in 2013, and on the back of that, it was a dissertation first, and then she converted it to a book, and then on the back of that, she got herself a gig as the Associate Professor of History of Christianity at Duke University. So that was her life then. Fascinating work that she does. But then in 2015, when she was 35, she was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. And her experiences over the next few years are going back to those people that she developed relationships with in prosperity gospel churches and saying, what have you got to say to me as a young woman, mum of a young kid who's now got stage 4 colon cancer? What does your tradition say back to me? She wrote a lovely book. I'd really recommend this book. Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved is the name of it. And she also now hosts a podcast called Everything Happens, which is pretty broad, but basically talks about how do you make meaning of suffering, very much from a Christian perspective, but interviews people very broadly. Through Lent this year, she's also been running free stuff on Instagram mainly, where she's just been talking every day through Lent, immersing herself through the Lent experience as an American who's a cancer survivor, and just watching her country fall apart, watching the health systems disintegrate, watching the death toll mounting, feeling powerless and feeling locked inside. She's articulated that beautifully and linked that back to the Lent process. And she's also running an online forum called Life Together Apart that anyone can have a look at. It's free, where she's discussing how do you live the Easter season in this context as well. Of all the slides I've written for you today, this is the one I found the hardest to write. I guess I'm so immersed in her stuff now, I find it hard to articulate why I like her stuff so much. But she's really lowbrow and accessible. And she talks about suffering in the contemporary context, which I find really helpful. She helps tease out what's the difference between performance positivity, which she talks about as part of the prosperity gospel tradition, like that sense that when you attend one of these churches, if someone says to you, how are you? The correct answer is actually blessed. It's not I'm good, I'm bad. It's not I'm unwell. It's not I'm struggling. The correct response, the etiquette of the church is blessed, is the response that you're supposed to give. So she teases out what is that versus optimism? What is hope? You know, and how do you work out which is the best for you, I guess. She gives some really helpful hints for living through times of calamity and how to structure your days and just keep plodding through. And she's really good at calling out Christian organisations for how that theology of prosperity actually ends up with victim-blaming theology and behaviour that just perpetuates social injustices that have been there since the start. And I guess one of the phrases that she and some of her co-writers keep coming back to when people are looking at, say, how the health system's coping in America with COVID is, the system isn't broken, the system was built like this. Trying to tease out what that means. And then for myself, what I find helpful is I'm Catholic. I'm part of a Catholic community as well as being hooked in with Matt, who, as some of you might remember, is Quaker. So our family straddles a few church traditions. So here's some of the things I've gleaned from my Catholic faith that I find helpful in how I manage and respond to fear. Firstly, I would say that memorized or rote prayer is not a faith fail and is not indicative of spiritual immaturity. So I think that's an important one to remind ourselves of. When people are in times of crisis, some parts of their brain work well and others not. And it's not unusual if you give someone terrible news that they then want to make themselves a cup of tea. They take action that is structured, repetitive and known to them, and that some part of that process is soothing and helps to center us. And sometimes rote prayer, such as whatever prayers you've been taught as the child or you know, different Christian traditions have their different repetitive prayers. Catholics have the rosary. Sometimes those prayers can be enormously helpful, and I don't think there's any point in regarding it as childish, as some disciplines sort of see it as that, but that's not how I see it. I also, I guess, have gained from my Catholic background to look at liturgy as being a really effective container for a whole lot of stuff. It can set structure at times when it's hard to find structure in your prayer life or everything seems topsy-turvy. And certainly for me, different aspects of the spoken mass have connected with me differently in COVID than they usually would. Different parts, different phrases jump out at me more. I think the take-home message from that is that it's just, for one thing, it's a really helpful reminder that the Christian mandate remains the same no matter what any of us as individuals are emotionally feeling at the time. It's not that my fear doesn't matter. It's not that my suffering doesn't matter. But also our mandate is not to care for the poor when we're feeling okay. You know, that even if we're terrified, the mandate remains. And that can be quite centering. It doesn't have to feel burdensome. Certainly every individual's capacity to act towards that mandate can be really influenced by their personal suffering and what they're feeling. And that's absolutely how it should be. But there's something quite centering about hearing the same thing being true, regardless of your own emotional state on that time or whatever the vibe is in the community at the time. I guess also in my experience, the Catholic Mass is a five senses experience. And there's so many different types of psychotherapy that have developed in the last 30 years that use grounding someone who's distressed via the five senses. And masses are designed to be a five senses experience. And that can be really useful. And then also another aspect of theology I think I've found useful is Sacred Heart theology. I'm sorry to say it's very hard for me to articulate why I find that useful, but it's just the concept, I think, of meeting Jesus in the wound. It's not that Jesus fixes suffering necessarily. It's that's the point of contact, stepping into that sacred space of the wound, and that's where the encounter occurs. It's not glamorizing suffering, and it's certainly not creating more suffering for suffering's sake, because goodness knows there's enough of that in the world anyway. But there's a whole set of imagery around that which I find comforting in a way I can't really articulate. Here's another thing I find useful about the Catholic stuff. It's just, we've got saints for it. Of course we've got saints for it. We've got saints for everything. We've got saints for everything. So, you know, just knowing pandemics are new to me, but they're not new to the humanity and they're not new to the Catholic Church. You know, so we've got a few case studies in the Catholic Church history about what sort of responses help and what don't. And there's some stuff about that that I find useful. So Marianne Cope is pictured on your screen there. She's actually a saint now. She's not blessed anymore. She was a German-based refugee woman who moved herself to Hawaii to help with the leprosy that was occurring in Hawaii. She died in 1918. She lived in desperate poverty with lepers for 30 years before her own death, and she didn't die of leprosy. The guy on the right there, that's Saint Edmund the Martyr. He was a king who was killed by the Danes. I mean, you look at that picture. He clearly didn't die of a pandemic, but he's the patron saint of pandemics. I can't tell you why he got that gig. He clearly didn't die like that by the look of that picture. Okay. I have a suggestion for a spiritual practice that we might attempt now together. Obviously, this is at your discretion. Some of you are going to find this of use and some of you not. And, of course, please, if you think this is not of use to you or of any risk to you, please don't feel obliged to even have a crack at it. Here's what I would suggest if you want to have a go at this. Using imagery of picturing whatever fear that you find the most, whatever emotion you find the most uncomfortable, be that fear or be that anger, whatever that emotion is that you personally find the most comfortable, getting an image of a box. I find a wooden box is good with that emotion in it. It's really important that the box has a clasp, right, in the imagery that you use. Whether it's a cardboard box or whatever, it doesn't matter, but it's good if it's got a clasp. And what I'm going to invite you to do is get a really clear image of Jesus or God or the Spirit or the Creator, whoever you image that, sitting next to you with their arm around you while you sit and hold the box. And sometimes if you want to, if you're engaging with that imagery, you can try, you choose when, you choose in your image to open the box and see what's in it. But that might, today might not be the day for that. May never be the day for that. Sometimes just sitting with the box in the company of God can be calming. And one way to do that is I find a lot of Australians connect well with the imagery of sitting around a campfire. So that's an image that works well, like getting an image of sitting at a campfire. God sitting next to me. God has her arm around me. I'm holding this box. And if at any point in the visualization it gets too heavy or it feels yuck, hand it to God. Just hand it to God. Just give it. at the end of this practice, you can close the box. And if it feels too heavy to close the box, just imagine God reaching over and closing the box for you and taking it out of your hands. And just see yourself stretching gently, recovering. Sometimes you can see God might hand you a couple of tissues. I don't know, whatever comes up. So that's what I'd suggest we do. Like, just sit with that imagery for 2 or 3 minutes. So can you see those questions? Yeah. That's just what I had suggested, but...
The comments on the meditation practice, Eden and I sat here to do this together, and as soon as I explained to Eden what we're doing and that we had the box, he said, I'm going to throw it in the fire now. And I thought that was pretty apt. I thought perhaps we're not the only ones who had that response.
That's awesome. Whatever works.
We then had a bit of a conversation about if you're not allowed to throw it in the fire and you've got to keep it, what are you going to do? There's actually, you can't throw it away. You're going to keep it. What are we going to do now?
That's great.
I wanted to sock a kid as far as I can.
I'm sorry, what did you say, Eden?
I wanted to sock a kid as far as I can.
Yeah, right. Yep. I think a lot of people feel that way about emotions like that. Absolutely.
The only problem with that, of course, is that maybe that box contained something really special that was a gift that was hiding in amongst all that other stuff.
Mm. I think someone else was commenting earlier about fear is functional. We really need it. You know, it's an important part of being human. It's really useful in some contexts.
That last little discussion starter point there just makes me think about fear. You're maybe leading on. It's part of the design. If you know, to take a very corny way, if we are part of a design. Or if we are God's creation and we have an indwelling presence of God because of that, then our fears also have an indwelling of God, perhaps. For me, that's been important in my life, as I've learnt that to go to God with my fears is not to have them excised so much as to have something different happened to them, but it's hard to put into words.
Something I notice when I sit down to pay attention to which emotion is the one I really don't want that I want to put in the box, is that it's hidden behind a wall of other emotions that are more acceptable. For me, I think it was fear that went in the box, but there's a lot of anger stands in front of it. And I often find that when I react in anger, it's because it's my body's response to not wanting to be afraid. I can be angry easier than I can be afraid.
Amen.
Hello. I was just going to say that I tend to think that if we accept that fear is a normal adaptive human response, and we accept that God made us as we are, then I find it really hard to accept that God doesn't like our fear and doesn't think that we should be afraid. And so I have kind of wrestled with some of the verses that have been discussed today in terms of being commanded by Christian peers. We'll talk about we're commanded to not be afraid. And first, I'm really interested in the language origins of what those words are actually telling us, but also, I guess, the cultural context. And I was thinking about when we have a friend or a loved one who is feeling afraid, we often say things like, oh, don't be scared and you'll be all right and don't worry. And I think that when we say that, we're not commanding them. We're not actually expecting them not to be afraid, but it's words that are just designed as comfort. And I kind of wonder when Jesus talked about don't be afraid, whether there might be something similar. So it's like, I know that you will be afraid and I really don't want you to be. That's all.
Yeah, that's also a bit like when a parent comforts you, they say, don't be afraid, I'm here. But what I was going to say was my meditation practice, and I've done this more times than I can remember, walking towards my work building, is as I stomp, praying, Father, bless me as I go, Jesus, walk beside me, Holy Spirit, guide me, over and over again. And the wonderful thing about that is that at different times it's easier to relate to one of the three, and depending on what the need is. But also it reminds me a bit of the bus idea that, you know, we're going there together. And I suppose the meditation that would come out of that would be, yeah, asking God to come on the bus with all the monsters. But you are actually traveling towards what you fear, with God. That's all.
For me, when anxiety and fear kicks in, emotional control diminishes completely.
My experience of going through a very, very anxious time, I remember being getting to a point where I was exhausted of all the emotions, and there was no energy left to feed it, and so I got to a place where I felt a real calm and almost, I mean, I wouldn't say suicidal as a sense, but the sense that it doesn't matter what happens, there's nothing that can happen, that there's nothing left. So there was a sense of absolute calm in that moment, and with a sense that God was present and everything was just okay. But I'm also then reminded of having seen some of the wartime images of, you know, of people about to be executed, and the sense of calm on some of their faces is just, I can't comprehend it, but the sense of going, have these people just accepted their own death imminently? Like, how do people go so calmly to their own death? I don't know. But the sense of going, well, there comes a point where fear just stops and there's a calmness, I think.
I've faced death more than once, and I find the words like we've got in Isaiah in front of us, do not be afraid, I am with you, very comforting, because for me that tells me that whatever I'm experiencing, no matter how bad it is, it's not going to last forever. It's temporary. It's part of my temporary life, even my own death. Whereas God is eternal. And I find that idea that God is eternal and will outlast everything really comforting.
This is probably a question, but the question is about the, for me, the concept of trust is very, very important. Trusting God is what I endeavour to do, and I'm wondering whether there are any thoughts from anyone on how trust and fear can coexist.
I think, you know, just like going for a walk, you just have to take, you know, go one step after the other, and you might be feeling a bit apprehensive about where you're going or what's happening, but you just have to keep trust that you're going to get there, you know. So I think that's just one way of sort of think about it for me.
Peter, I was wondering if that quotation from Isaiah could also be restated as, "Do not be afraid of being afraid, I am with you."
I think there's an element of which I learnt was the feeling itself or the struggle against it, and I think talked about it before that the avoidance of it. But it's like if you allow your feelings to be present, and like we just did with them and ponder them for a bit, then they tend to eventually leave of their own accord, whereas if you fight against it, it's actually more painful for much longer.
I was just responding in my mind to a few things, including Tyson's that sense of getting to the end, not seeing the result as being something that you can influence, maybe. And an example, fear that I felt is parachuting, where you are in a plane and you decide to let go of it, and if you don't, someone hits you over the knuckles with a piece of wood and you'd let go anyway. But that thing, what happens is you just lose consciousness for a moment and you kind of wake up. I don't know, not sure how much longer it takes for you to snap out of that, but maybe part of the beautiful design that we're part of is that we actually lose consciousness, or we actually shut down some of our functioning in order to go through that fear.
Okay, well, we might leave it there. I'd like to thank you very much, Sophia, for talking to us today. That was really enlightening and encouraging, and I hope things continue to improve in New South Wales. So I'd like to finish with a benediction from Looney, with apologies because I've tampered a bit with his prayer. It goes like this. There are only two feelings, love and fear. There are only two languages, love and fear. There are only two activities, love and fear. There are only two motives, two procedures, two frameworks, two results, love and fear. Love and fear. May we trust you, Lord, for the love and the fear. Amen.